The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban, and you're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. Yes, we're now North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. We begin the combined July-August 2019 edition of Smithsonian with Sweet Science. Archaeologists are discovering that two of the world's most prized flavors have a much richer history than we thought. There's a picture of a vanilla plant. Vanilla beans began as seed pods of a tropical orchid. Chocolate is made from the seeds hidden inside the fruit of the cacao tree. And there are drawings of those. Of all the great debates, Coke versus Pepsi, boxers versus briefs, shaken versus stirred, few have been more polarizing than chocolate versus vanilla. Those of us aligned with chocolate, the product of ground-roasted cacao beans, find it warm, comforting, ambrosial, and generally dismiss all things unchocolate as vanilla, meaning bland and boring. Those who prefer vanilla, a climbing orchid that bears long pod-like fruit, praise its aromatic sweetness and note that it enhances the flavor of chocolate, which unembellished would be dull and kind of flat. In short, vanilla. The one aspect of the chocolate and vanilla divide that has seldom been disputed is the question of provenance. But over the last year, two new studies have radically rejiggered the origin stories of both. On the chocolate front, the earliest chemical evidence of cacao use has been pushed about 1,400 years further into the past and about 2,000 miles south. For vanilla's part, researchers now believe that the beans were not only used by humans more than two millennia earlier than previously thought, but an entire ocean away. These findings are just a couple of the latest examples of how archaeologists, geneticists, and cultural anthropologists are rewriting history through the study of food. The earliest use of vanilla has long been attributed to the Totonac community in what is now the Mexican state of Veracruz. They gathered the fragrant seed pods from orchids that grew wild in the forest. Much later, they domesticated the vines, which can take up to 5 years to mature. Each flower must be pollinated the one day that it blooms, or else the stem bears no fruit. In Mexico, Vanilla planifolia co-evolved with its pollinator, the Melipona bee. According to Totonac legend, the humble beginnings of the vanilla industry can be placed to 13th century Papantla, known as the city that perfumed the world. The native peoples were very knowledgeable about the medicinal use of herbs and may well have ground the vanilla bean for lung and stomach disorders, as well as used the liquid from the green beans as a poultice for drawing out insect venom and infections from wounds. Patricia Rain explains in Vanilla, Her Cultural History of the Spice. The Aztecs, who subjugated the Totonacs in 1480, knew the plant as Tlaxtila, or black pod, a name which would be translated erroneously as black flower, leading to centuries of confusion over the primrose yellow petals. Tribute was exacted in the form of cured beans, an indispensable ingredient in the savory chocolate drink cacahuatl, C-A-C-A-H-U-A-T-L, also enlivened with chilies, which became the beverage of choice of Aztec nobility. In 1519, Montezuma II and the Spanish invader Hernan Cortes famously quaffed the cold, frothy brew at a feast in the capital Tenochtitlan, now Mexico City. Some 75 years after Cortes returned to Europe with the pods, Hugh Morgan, the apothecary and pastry chef of Queen Elizabeth I, suggested that vanilla could be used as a flavoring all by itself. From then on, Her Majesty, a sugar freak with conspicuously rotted teeth, indulged in vanilla-infused sweetmeats. Thomas Jefferson discovered the flavor during a visit to France in the late 1700s. When he found none available on his return to Philadelphia, he wrote to the American Chargé d'Affaires in Paris, asking him to send him 50 pods wrapped in newspapers. With a flourish of a pen and the help of a friend, writes Rain, he saw that Vanilla had traveled nearly full circle back to the Americas. Now comes word that Vanilla may have become a thing in the old world before the new one. Researchers have pinpointed the earliest known example of the spice in northern Israel. Soaked into three small jugs recovered at a site in Megiddo was a sweet surprise, two of the main chemicals in vanilla, 4-hydroxybenzaldehyde and vanillin, a compound that forms tiny white crystals on the pod's surface as the bean ferments. The expedition, organized by Israel Finkelstein of Tel Aviv University, had the makings of a mummy screenplay. An undisturbed 3,600-year-old Canaanite tomb, three intact skeletons, and a hoard of gold and silver jewelry. Call it the Thrilla in Vanilla. The vessel sat beside the skeletons. The tomb is probably associated with the royal family of Megiddo, or its entourage, Finkelstein says. It is just several meters from the remains of the palace. It's possible that the vanilla was mixed with plant oil to create a perfume, either to purify the burial chamber or to anoint the corpse before interment. Vanilla has antimicrobial properties that could help to preserve a body before burial, says University of California, Berkeley archaeologist Melissa Craddock, who led the examination of the tomb. Another possibility is that vanilla-scented perfumes were deposited in the burial as an expensive offering for the dead. Botanical history suggests that the vanillin found in jugs in modern-day Israel may have come from orchids native to Southeast Asia or East Africa. Finkelstein thinks the vanillin probably arrived in the Middle East through extensive Bronze Age trade routes. This find is the tip of the iceberg, Craddock says, and represents only the beginning of our understanding of cultivation, exchange, and uses of vanilla in the ancient world. As if this discovery weren't enough to make a 6-year-old switch to strawberry, the birthday of chocolate has also been thrown into doubt by science. Based on a sample from a ceramic jar, it has been believed that the history of chocolate began with the Mocaya, sedentary villagers who occupied the Soconus region of Mexico's Pacific coast. Around 1900 BC, the Mocayas began to consume Theobroma cacao, a plant that thrives in the upper reaches of the Amazon. There followed a succession of Mesoamerican societies, Olmec, Toltec, Maya, Aztec, that found ways to exploit the bean, which was variously used as a monetary unit, a measuring unit, and a meal. It wasn't until 1847 that the British company J.S. Fry and Sons of Bristol produced the first solid chocolate bar offered to the general public. Turns out that our love affair with chocolate predates the Mocaya. New research indicates that cacao was originally used in the humid forests of the upper Amazon basin, where the tree is at its most genetically diverse. Investigators looked at jars and shards of pottery from Santa Ana La Florida, an archaeological site in Ecuador once inhabited by the Mayo Chinchipi people, and detected signs of chocolate tippling from as long as 5,300 years ago. A team of archaeologists and biologists from universities in North America, South America, and Europe identified preserved starch grains from the genus Theobroma, which includes the species T. cacao, inside the artifacts, along with theobromine, a bitter alkaloid produced more abundantly by T. cacao than its wild relatives. The clincher: ancient DNA with sequences that match those of modern cacao trees. Ethnographic and ethnobotanical descriptions of indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin have led archaeologist Michael Blake, a co-author of the paper, to suspect that the plants were used medicinally and ceremonially. As you might expect, in a study involving the contentious topic of chocolate, those conclusions are not universally accepted. Some scientists question whether the Mayo Chinchipi prepared the seeds for eating, an elaborate process of fermentation, drying, roasting, and grinding, or simply collected pods. Others have challenged the idea that the cacao plants made the passage from South America. another recent analysis pegged cacao cultivation to about 3,600 years ago in Central America. If this new food scholarship has shown us anything, it's that nothing, not even chocolate and vanilla, is ever just black and white. And there's a graphic here of the continent of Europe and the continent of Africa, and the title, Yesterday's Specials, Where and When the Foods That Changed Human History Arrived on the Menu. Starting in the upper left corner, caviar, the earliest physical evidence of roe consumption, was recently found on a 6,000-year-old potsherd from Central Europe. The fish eggs may have been cooked in water. This is pointing at Germany. In the upper right corner, beer. Brewing came before agriculture, say researchers, who learned that semi-nomadic Naturians quaffed wheat and barley beer circa 11,000 BC, 7,000 years before farmers did in Central Asia. And then going around to nutmeg, this pumpkin spice latte flavoring appears in 14th century trade records, but study of pottery from Indonesia now shows that the nutmeg fruit was used as early as 1500 BC. It points to an island just off into Indonesia. And wine, pointing up to Georgia and Turkey, the oldest known grape wine, and lots of it, was produced around 6000 BC, say scientists who studied residue in jars unearthed in Georgia. Perhaps chemical analysis dated wine to Iran circa 5400 BC. Cheese, and this points to Turkey and Egypt. Cheese, in 2018, researchers discovered 3,200-year-old cheese in an Egyptian tomb, but new molecular analysis of a pot dug up in Turkey reveals evidence of cheese making circa 5900 BC. Bread. Some stale breadcrumbs have changed history. It now appears that semi-nomadic Natufians made flatbread circa 12,000 BC, 4,000 years before farmers in what is now Turkey. We switch to literature. A Lost Work by Langston Hughes. In 1933, the Harlem Renaissance star wrote a powerful essay about race. It has never been published in English until now. By Stephen Holscher, H-O-E-L-S-C-H-E-R. It's not every day that you come across an extraordinary, unknown work by one of the nation's greatest writers, but buried in an unrelated archive I recently discovered, a searing essay condemning racism in America by Langston Hughes, the moving account published in its original form here for the first time, of an escaped prisoner he met while traveling with Zora Neale Hurston. In the summer of 1927, Hughes lit out for the American South to learn more about the religion, to learn more about the region that loomed large in his literary imagination. After giving a poetry reading at Fisk University in Nashville, Hughes journeyed by train through Louisiana and Mississippi before embarking in Mobile, Alabama. There, to his surprise, he ran into Hurston, his friend and fellow author. Described by Yuval Taylor in his new book, Zora and Langston, as one of the more fortuitous meetings in American literary history, the encounter brought together two leading lights of the Harlem Renaissance. On the spot, the pair decided to drive back to New York City together in Hurston's small Nash coupe. The terrain along the back roads of the rural South was new to Hughes, who grew up in the Midwest. By contrast, Hurston's southern roots and training as a folklorist made her a knowledgeable guide. In his journal, Hughes described the black people they met in their travels, educators, sharecropping families, blues singers, and conjurers. Hughes also mentioned the chain gang prisoners forced to build the roads they traveled on. 3 years later, Hughes gave the poor, young, and mostly black men of the chain gang a voice in his satirical poem, Road Workers. But we now know that the images of these men in gray and black striped uniforms continue to linger in the mind of the writer. In his newly discovered manuscript, Hughes revisited the route he traveled with Hurston, telling the story of their encounter with one young man picked up for fighting and sentenced to hard labor on the chain gang. I first stumbled upon this Hughes essay in the papers of John L. Spivak, a white investigative journalist in the 1920s and 1930s at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Not even Hughes' authoritative biographer, Arnold Rempersand, could identify the manuscript. Eventually, I learned that Hughes had written it as an introduction to a novel Spivak published in 1932. The book was a blistering exposé of the atrocious conditions that African Americans suffered on chain gangs, and Spivak gave it a deliberately provocative title to reflect the brutality he saw. Scholars today consider the forced labor system a form of slavery by another name. On the final page of the manuscript, not reproduced here, Hughes wrote that by blazing the way to truth, Spivak had written a volume of great importance to the Negro peoples. Hughes titled these three typewritten pages, Forward from Life, and in them he also laid bare his fears of driving through Jim Crow America. We knew that it was dangerous for Northern Negroes to appear too interested in the affairs of the rural South, he wrote. Hurston packed a chrome-plated pistol for protection during the road trip. But a question remained. Why wasn't Hughes' essay included in any copy of Spivak's book I had ever seen? Buried in Spivak's papers, I found the answer. Hughes' essay was written a year after the book was published, commissioned to serve as the foreword of the 1933 Soviet edition, and published only in Russia. In early 1933, Hughes was living in Moscow, where he was heralded as a revolutionary writer. He had originally traveled there a year earlier, along with 21 other influential African Americans, to participate in a film about American racism. The film had been a bust. No one could agree on the script. But escaping white supremacy in the United States, at least temporarily, was immensely appealing. The Soviet Union at that time promoted an idea of racial equality that Hughes longed for. He also found that he could earn a living entirely from his writing. For this Russian audience, Hughes reflected on a topic as relevant today as it was in 1933, the injustice of black incarceration. And he captured the story of a man that, like the stories of so many other young black men, would otherwise be lost. We may even know his name. Hughes' journal mentions one Ed Pinckney, a young escapee whom Hughes and Hurston met near Savannah. We don't know what happened to him after their interaction. But by telling the story, Hughes forces us to wonder. Forward from Life by Langston Hughes. I had once a short but memorable experience with a fugitive from a chain gang in this very same Georgia of which John L. Spivak writes. I had been lecturing on my poetry at some of the Negro universities in the South, and with a friend I was driving north again in a small automobile. All day since sunrise, we had been bumping over the hard red clay roads, characteristic of the backward sections of the South. We had passed two chain gangs that day, one in the morning grading a country road, and the other about noon, a group of Negroes in gray and black striped suits, bending and rising under the hot sun, digging a drainage ditch at the side of the highway. We wanted to stop and talk to the men, but we were afraid. The white guards on horseback glared at us as we slowed down our machine, so we went on. On our automobile there was a New York license, and we knew it was dangerous for Northern Negroes to appear too interested in the affairs of the rural South. Even peaceable Negro salesmen had been beaten and mobbed by whites who objected to seeing a neatly dressed colored person speaking decent English and driving his own automobile. So we did not stop to talk to the chain gangs as we went by. But that night, a strange thing happened. After sundown and the evening dusk, we were nearing the city of Savannah. We noticed a dark figure waving at us frantically from the swamps at the side of the road. We saw that it was a black boy. "Can I go with you to town?" the boy stuttered. His words were hurried, as though he were frightened, and his eyes glanced nervously up and down. "Get in," I said. He sat between us on the single seat. "Do you live in Savannah?" we asked. "No, sir," the boy said. "I live in Atlanta." We noticed that he put his head down nervously when the other automobiles passed ours and seemed afraid. "And where have you been?" we asked apprehensively. "On the chain gang," he said simply. "We were startled. They let you go today?" "No, sir. I ran away. That's why I was afraid to walk in the town. I saw you all was colored and I waved to you. I thought maybe you would help me." Gradually, before the lights of Savannah came in sight, in answer to our many questions, he told us his story. Picked up for fighting, prison, the chain gang. But not a bad chain gang, he said. They didn't beat you as much in this one. Only once the guard had knocked two teeth out. That was all. But he couldn't stand it any longer. He wanted to see his wife in Atlanta. He had been married only 2 weeks when they sent him away, and she needed him. He needed her. So he had made it to the swamp. A colored preacher gave him clothes. Now for 2 days he hadn't eaten, only running. He had to get to Atlanta. But aren't you afraid, we asked? They might arrest you in Atlanta and send you back to the same gang for running away. Atlanta is still in the state of Georgia. Come up north with us, we pleaded. To New York, there are no chain gangs, and Negroes are not treated so badly. Then you'll be safe. He thought a while. When we assured him that he could travel with us, that we would hide him in the back of the car where the baggage was, and that he could work in the north and send for his wife, he agreed slowly to come. But ain't it cold up there? He said. Yes, we answered. In Savannah, we found a place for him to sleep and gave him $0.50 for food. We will come for you at dawn, we said. But when, in the morning, we passed the house where he stayed, we were told that he had already gone before daybreak. We did not see him again. Perhaps the desire to go home had been greater than the wish to go north to freedom. Or perhaps he had been afraid to travel with us by daylight, or suspicious of our author. Or maybe... dot, dot, dot. Next up, U-Tunes. Singing the praises of the Walkman, which launched the revolution in self-centered music 40 years ago, by Clive Thompson. In 1979, when Sony introduced the Walkman, a 14-ounce cassette player, blue and silver, with buttons that made a satisfying chunk when pushed, even the engineers inside Sony weren't impressed. It wasn't particularly innovative. Cassette players already existed, and so did headphones. Plus, the Walkman could only play back. It couldn't record. Who was going to want a device like that? Millions of consumers, it turns out. The $200 device, over $700 in today's money, as pricey as a smartphone, instantly became a hit, selling out its initial run of 30,000 in Japan. When it went on sale in Bloomingdale's in New York City, the waiting list stretched to 2 months. An early version of the Walkman now resides in the collections of the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. What was the allure? The sudden portability of gorgeous head-filling sound. Previously, if you wanted to hear hi-fi music on headphones, you were stuck tethered to a home stereo. The Walkman unmoored you. Now you could walk down the street, and the music altered the very existence of looking at the world. Everything, the pulsing of traffic, the drift of snowflakes, passers wandering by on the sidewalk, seemed laden with new meaning. Life became a film, as Andreas Pavel, an inventor who patented his own prototype of an Ur Walkman years before Sony, once noted. It emotionalized your life. It actually put magic into your life. Or as one 16-year-old Walkman wearer described it in historian Ike Weber's account, I have my own world. Somehow I see it differently and hear it differently and feel stronger. People used the Walkman to help manage their moods and calm stress. Dennis would plop Walkman headphones on a patient before drilling. Andy Warhol tuned out the din of Manhattan. It's nice to hear Pavarotti instead of car horns, he said. The device also became a fashion statement, a badge of modernity. Sony's ads portrayed a roller-skating couple joyfully sailing along, Walkman held aloft. For the first time, sporting a piece of cutting-edge hardware was fashionable, not dorky. It was the first mass mobile device, notes Rebecca Tullis Dubarrow, author of Personal Stereo. It changed how people inhabited public space in a pretty profound way. It paved the way for acceptance of the mobile phone, today's truly omnipresent portable tech. But much like the mobile phone, the Walkman tore a rent in its social fabric. To use one was to intentionally seal the public out. It's the privatizing of space, Michael Bull, a University of Sussex professor who studied Walkman users in the 90s, told me. Personal stereos are visual, do not disturb signs. he wrote in his book Sounding Out the City. Earlier, transistor radios, which had single earpieces, didn't have that effect. The experience of listening to your Walkman is intensely insular, as the music critic Vince Jackson wrote in the British magazine Touch. It signals a desire to cut yourself off from the rest of the world at the touch of a button. You close your eyes and you could be anywhere. Bull, for his part, said listening to a Walkman was healthy, a kind of assertion of autonomy. Plenty agreed. To them, it seemed fantastically rude. Our marriage or your Sony, as graphic designer James Miho's wife warned him in 1980, after, as the New York Times reported, he tuned her out for reggae. The philosopher Alan Bloom, in The Closing of the American Mind, inveighed against the specter of a boy doing his homework with a Walkman on. A pubescent boy whose body throbs with orgasmic rhythms, a generation of kids cut off from great literature. As long as they have the Walkman on, they cannot hear what the great tradition has to say. Soon enough, the Walkman was a symbol of navel-gazing self-absorption. Critics mocked narcissistic yuppies for listening to self-help books on their commutes to upscale jobs, and derided Gen X slackers for lethargically dropping out, sitting in an emo trance. A technology for a generation with nothing left to say, Der Spiegel reported. You couldn't win no matter how you used it, Tuhas de Brouwer laughs. Interestingly, Sony itself was worried the machine encouraged antisocial behavior. Sony's boss, Akio Morita, ordered that the first Walkman include a second headphone jack, so two could listen at once. But it turns out nobody wanted it. People wanted to listen by themselves. Yet people did indeed create a vibrant social culture around the Walkman. They shared earbuds, they made mixtapes for friends or dates. Indeed, making mixtapes, stitching together songs from one's home stereo to make a new compilation, became a distinctly modern activity. The message was not in any one song, but in their combination, their sequencing. Mixtapes marked the moment of consumer culture in which listeners attained control over what they heard, in what order, and at what cost. Mixtapes also helped fuel the panic over copyright, with the music industry launching a campaign claiming that home taping is killing music. It didn't kill music, of course, but gave us a glimpse of our coming 21st century world, where we live surrounded by media, holding a device in our hands at all times. And that familiar music tells us our time's up. We hope you've enjoyed today's edition of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. Our new name is North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.